we start tonight a new unit here on sin. And that's actually the last part of this study on the doctrine of man. We have looked at the original state of man. We asked the question, how did God create man? And we know, of course, that God created man in the image of God. Not a physical image, but a mental, moral, and social likeness. We then looked at the nature of man, in particular into dichotomy and trichotomy. Is man made up of two parts or three parts? Is there a material and immaterial part, or is he made up of three parts, body, soul, and spirit? With soul and spirit, by some people, considered to be different. And we observe really that man is a dichotomous being, material and immaterial. We then looked at the covenant of works, and the covenant that God made with Adam, when he said, you know, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. So the covenant that God had made with man. And we know, of course, that man did not keep that covenant. So we looked then also at the fall. So we looked at that and concluded that last week. So that brings us to sin. And we begin by asking the question, what is sin? Giving the answer there again from the Shorter Catechism, as that is often a very helpful answer there. But the Shorter Catechism, in answer to question 14, says, sin is any want of conformity unto or transgression of a law of God. So you see, in a sense, there's two parts to that answer. A want of conformity unto or transgression of the law of God. In one sense, it is not measuring up to the standard that God has set, but then also it means to break the commandment that God has set. So we see there, maybe sometimes it's been used as illustration how in some countries they have not only a maximum speed limit on certain roads, but also a minimum speed limit. And that can be a helpful picture to understand that. I think particularly on some of the freeways that we have seen, or not necessarily freeways, but toll roads that we have seen in the United States, where very often there is a minimum speed limit as well as a maximum speed limit. So if you go too slow, you're actually a hazard on the road. Because if everybody is doing 100 and you're doing 60, you know, you're driving all the, you've got to slam on the brakes because you get through that car so quick. A lot of accidents happen when cars go too slow. So they're not meeting the minimum standard that was required. On the other hand, if you go 120, you're also breaking the speed limit. So, you know, so that's the idea. A want or lack of conformity unto, you're not measuring up to the minimum standard that God has given. Or there is a transgression of the law, that means God says don't, and you do anyway. So that is the definition then, sort of catechism, what is sin. Sin is any want of conformity unto or transgression of the law of God. Now, the two words that are used here, both the Hebrew and the Greek word, the Hebrew word is chata, and the Hebrew verb is hamartano. I've given both of these in the notes here. But in both cases, the basic idea, the root idea of these two verbs is to miss the mark. So it's like the archer. You know, this was a picture that was commonly used. Back then, there was a lot more archery than they do today. It's only maybe for sporting events, you know, to have the archery. But then, of course, in the time of war, it was bow and arrow. So if you shot at the target and you missed it, you sinned. So that is the root idea. So a missing the target when you're shooting with your bow and arrow. And the Hebrew, as I say, is chata, and the Greek is hamartano. And if you take the word hamartano, you know, when we study the doctrine of man, we say that in a fancy, the technical term is anthropology, made up of two Greek words, anthropos, man, and logia, or logos, meaning word or study of, or the doctrine of. So the doctrine of man, theology, the study or the doctrine of theos or God, you know, Christology, the doctrine or study of Christ. But there's also a hamartology. And it's not a word that we use an awful lot, but it is a word that is used. So you can understand that hamartology would then be the doctrine of sin. So there is actually a technical term for all this that we're doing here. Same as the doctrine of the Holy Spirit, pneumatology. So we have the word pneuma for spirit. So hamartano is the verb, you know, hamartia is the noun of sin, and then hamartology, the doctrine of sin. So meaning to miss the mark. And so as a result then, it is to do wrong or to sin. Now we often consider the subject of sin in relation to the law. So we say if the speed limit says on a certain road 80 kilometers an hour, if we do 100, we are sinning. We're breaking the law. But the biblical view of sin does not depend wholly or entirely upon the concept of law. For the biblical writers actually appeal to the holy character of God as the basis of law. If you look, for instance, at Leviticus chapter 19, Leviticus chapter 19, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. So a verse that is well familiar with you. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. In Peter, 1 Peter, you know, be ye holy, for I am holy. So reference is there coming back to the book of Leviticus. So it is a question of the holiness of God. God is of, you know, purer eyes than to behold evil. So when you think then of this concept of sin, it is not simply a question of God has said, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. You know, we have, of course, those commandments. And we know from that it's wrong to steal, it's wrong to kill. But there is more to it than that, because it ultimately comes back to the holiness of God. So that's why we say that. The biblical writers appeal to the holy character of God as the basis of the law, because God says, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then also, if you look at Isaiah chapter 6, which is a fascinating passage there, you know, the first five verses, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above it, above the throne, stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings, with twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. I think that's the verse that you are familiar with, you know, with the three times the holy, 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 holy. We see that twice. We see it here in Isaiah, and it's also mentioned in the book of Revelation. And the hymn, holy, 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 I've mentioned before, is based on the words in the book of Revelation, not actually based on the words here. But you see it, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the post of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. So this is what Isaiah sees. The year the King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. Somehow God revealed himself to Isaiah. He saw that. He sees these seraphim crying out, "Holy, holy, holy." And then his own reaction in verse 5, "Then said I, woe is me, for I am undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." So that's his reaction. You know, it's not that he reacts because he says, "I've broken God's law," but he reacts when he sees the holiness of God. "Holy, holy, holy, then said I, woe is me, for I am undone." So again, you see then that Isaiah's feeling of sin is based on the holiness of God. So that is where we go, the holiness of God. So sin then is not only violation of divine law, which is an expression of God's will, it is violation of the expression of God's holy character. It is corruption of the goodness which God originally imparted to his creatures. Especially is it a corruption of the godliness with which God originally endowed man when he created him in his own image. Because remember, when God created man, it was with knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. These three things. So when God created Adam, it was with knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. So the knowledge was affected by sin, but he still had some knowledge. But then the righteousness and holiness, they were lost because of sin. Now they can be restored through Christ. Alright? But they were lost. And so that's what we say here. You know, you see God working. He had originally endowed man with a holiness, with a godliness, and then because of the sin, he no longer had that. So that's why we say sin is not only then a violation of the divine law. Thou shalt not kill. If you kill, you have broken the law. Thou shalt not steal. You've stolen. You have broken the divine law. So that's an expression of God's will. You know, that's why sometimes people say, "What's God's will for my life?" Well, the Ten Commandments is a good place to begin, because that's a revelation of the will of God. God makes it very clear. Don't worship false gods. You know, don't worship idols. Honor your father and the mother. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. You know, all these things, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. All these are expressions of the will of God. It is God's will that we worship him only. It is God's will that we do not worship idols or statues. It is God's will that we not use his name in vain. It is God's will that we keep the Sabbath day holy. It is God's will that we honor our parents. So we have all these things there. This is what God's will is for our lives, as he has revealed it there. So that's why sin then is not only the violation of the law as God is giving it to us, but it's also the violation of the expression of God's holy character, because we have lost that holiness with which man was originally created. So sin may then be defined as anything in the creature which does not express or which is contrary to the holy character of the Creator God. So anything there, you know, what is there, but it does not express the holiness of God. It is contrary to the holiness of God. So all that is sin. Sin, we often say transgression of the law. True. Sin is a transgression of the law. We read that in the Word of God. But there is more involved in it than that. So the conformity unto or transgression of the law of God, so if you do not express or are contrary to the holy character of God, that is all sin. Now, that sin, we know, is universal. One reason we know that is because of the sin of Adam. So we know that we are today born with a sinful nature. But it's interesting too, if you talk about the universality of sin, that even if you don't look at the, we will look at the Bible by the way, but if you look at the history of religions, or if you look at philosophy, and if you look at all the different cultures there are, you will find that all cultures have the concept of sin. And that's why this is a very interesting study. If you go from biblical anthropology to a secular anthropology, a secular study of man, you'll find that wherever you go, there's some kind of a creation account. And I put it down, some kind of. Now, it could be the Aboriginal dreaming, and it could be the other way, but all cultures have some concept of how we got here. You know, they all have a flood account, which is another interesting thing. But they also all have some concept of sin. Alright? So, that's why I say, the heathen religions testify to universal consciousness of sin and of the need of reconciliation with a supreme being. Now, we're not going to do any exhaustive study in comparative religions. You know, but it's interesting when you do that and start reading, you know, whether you start reading on Buddhism or you start reading on Hinduism or, you know, whatever religion there may be around the world, but if you start reading on these and try to find out, they all have some concept of sin. So, you know, we see that. And how do we reconcile with the Supreme Being, whatever they call the Supreme Being, whether they call him God or whatever they call him. You know, different terms are used by different, you know, people groups. But there is a general feeling, wherever you go among these different groups, that the gods are offended and must be propitiated, satisfied in some way. So we got to keep the gods happy. And you see this maybe in river gods that have to be kept happy. So we throw people or babies into the river so that the river god is pacified and happy. You know, or we may have the volcano gods, and so we throw young girls into the volcano because we need to keep the volcano god happy, because otherwise the volcano will erupt. Of course, these are all non-biblical concepts, but this is what some of the cultures have believed. So they need to satisfy their small g gods, whether it's a river god, or whether it's a volcano god, or whatever god they might have. So that's why I say, there is a general feeling that the gods are offended and must be propitiated, satisfied in some way. There's also a universal voice of conscience testifying to the fact that man falls short of the ideal and stands condemned in the sight of some higher power. So again, you see that there's some higher power, some supreme being that we must keep happy. But again, there is this universal concept or universal idea of a conscience. So it's not only that we have that concept taught in the Bible, but all peoples have that idea of conscience, doing something that's right or doing something that's wrong. You know, so altars reeking with the blood of sacrifices, and often the sacrifice of children, repeated confessions of wrongdoing, and prayers for deliverance from evil, they all point to the consciousness of sin. And missionaries have found it wherever they go. That's very interesting. You know, it's John Payton, missionary to the New Hebrides, now called Vanuatu. You know, but he wrote quite an extensive autobiography of his life as he grew up and how he went to the New Hebrides. And he also reports how on a number of occasions, he came to Australia, because from, you know, Vanuatu to Australia, not very far. So he would come to Australia, and he had a lot of contact with the Aborigines. And he was told, oh, the Aborigines don't have any religion. But it was actually Peyton who found out that the Aborigines did have a religion. It was just something they didn't want to tell the white man about. But he found out anyway. They saw them having bags with things in there. Those were some of their sacred objects. So he found also, of course, since then we've come to learn a lot more about the Aboriginal dreaming and all. But you know, it was actually a missionary, Peyton, that found out that the Aborigines here in Australia did have a religion. And if you ever managed to get hold of the biography of John Peyton, you know, I have a copy of it somewhere in a box, hidden somewhere. But fascinating. And I make that when I teach, you know, some of my subjects, teaching, I actually have that as a required reading, because it makes it so interesting to see what he found, two chapters in there, where he deals with the Aborigines in Australia. Since we're all living in Australia, you might be interested in reading about that. All right, well, you see that. So wherever missionaries have gone around the world, they have found some consciousness of sin, some awareness of sin, and of trying to satisfy the gods, whatever gods they are. So, and usually with sacrifices. And like I say in the notes, often the sacrifices of children. So the history then of philosophy is indicative of the same fact. All right, because even the early Greek philosophers, and when you study philosophy, especially the history of philosophy, you go back normally to the Greek philosophers, all right? And, you know, I can remember the textbook that we used for philosophy, you know, from Thales to whatever it was that the book ended up with, but Thales, T-H-A-L-E-S, one of the early Greek philosophers. You know, you have Plato, you know, as an early philosopher. And they had some interesting ideas there. But, you know, if you go back, the early Greek philosophers were already wrestling with the problem of moral evil. And since their day, no philosopher's name has been able to ignore it, this moral evil or sin. You know, it's a very interesting subject, philosophy, you know, that study the question of being, you know, do I exist? You know, which is such an interesting question, do I exist? You know, I think, therefore I am. You know, cogito ergo sum. So I think, and if I can think, well then I must exist, you know. Then there is the epistemology, so that's metaphysics, the question of being, do I exist? But then there's the epistemology, the question of knowing. So how can I know? So the philosophers used to start out with the metaphysics on the question of existence, but then there's been a shift where they later on they start saying, no, 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 before I can talk about existence, I must talk about knowing. Can I know anything at all? All right. So philosophers are crazy people, you know, sometimes. All right. And then you go in the area of logic, and you go in the area of values, axiology. It's a fascinating subject to study, and interesting to read. But even the early Greek philosophers, we're talking now about, say, 2,500 years ago, so they were already dealing with some of these issues. And no philosopher's name has really been able to ignore it. You go to more recently Alfred North Whitehead or Bertrand Russell, some of your modern, more modern philosophers, they all dealt with that subject. So they were all constrained to admit the universality of sin, and that in spite of the fact they were not able to explain the phenomenon. So they couldn't really explain it, but they had to admit it is universal. All right, so quite interesting. So that's why as we talked about the universality of sin, you know, we're not looking now at the Bible, but we're looking at just secular history, philosophy. We're looking at different cultures and societies. They all have some concept of right and wrong. In other words, of what is sin and what is not. But of course, as Christians, we're more concerned about the teaching of the Bible. So the Bible also clearly teaches the universality of sin. And we want to look at just again a few verses, not a lot of verses, but just a few verses that make it very clear, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 46. Alright, if they sin against thee, for there is no man that sinneth not, and thou be angry with them and deliver them to the enemy, so that they carry them away captives unto the land of the enemy, far or near. Now that verse is kind of picked out here in the context, but it's a very clear statement. There is no man that sinneth not. So if there's no man that does not sin, that means that all sin. So 1 Kings 8:46 clearly teaches that all men sin. Psalm 143 and verse 2. And enter not into judgment with thy servant, for in thy sight shall no man living be justified. Alright? In thy sight, that is in God's sight, shall no man living be justified, or shall no man be righteous, because all have sinned. So hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear to my supplications, in thy faithfulness answer me, and in thy righteousness, and enter not into judgment with thy servant. For in thy sight shall no man living be justified. And then the next book, of course, Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 9. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 9. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I am pure from my sin? Who can say that? The answer is obvious. Nobody can say that. Who can say, I have made my heart clean? Nobody can say, I have made my heart clean. Nobody can say, I am pure from my sin. So here again, we see clearly that the Bible teaches the universality of sin, or that all have sinned. And that, of course, how it's put in the New Testament. Key chapter here, of course, Romans chapter 3, and beginning at verse 10. You know, but let me begin to read in verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? Are we Jews better than they Gentiles? No, in no wise. For we have before proved both Jews and Gentiles that they are all under sin. Romans chapter 1, the Gentiles have sinned. Romans chapter 2, the Jews have sinned. Romans chapter 3, all have sinned. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Their throat is an open sepulchre. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips. Whoso whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that what things soever the law says, it says to them that are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. And then going down to verse 23, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But you know, you see it so clear. There is none righteous, no, not one. You know, there is none that doeth good, no, not one. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So very clear again that the Bible teaches here in the New Testament the fact that all have sinned, or the universality of sin. And then also 1 John chapter 1. And we often quote verse 9, but just before it is in verse 8. If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Oh, I have not sinned, I have not sinned. Well, you're deceiving yourself. And I can remember it was an interesting case. I was in Malaysia, one of our BP churches there, and I was asked, can you baptize, you know, as was arranged ahead of time. And so, yeah, I can baptize the people, but I do want to talk to them before I baptize. And so the one man I asked, you know, have you sinned? And he said, no. Now that was kind of interesting. You know, somebody says, no, I have not sinned. So I said, well, better pursue that a little bit further. And, well, you know, what do you mean by you have not sinned? And he said, well, since I received Christ as my Savior, I have not sinned. Well, what do you mean by sin? Well, I haven't murdered anybody. You know, and you know, I haven't done anything really bad. So his concept of sin was only so-called big sins. You know, but then when pursue it, you know, if you ever lose your temper or you ever use a bad word, well, yes. So he had to admit that there was some sin still there. But he's trying to say that he has not done anything really, really, really bad. It's, you know, well, man has since died and gone to be with the Lord. But, you know, it was interesting to interview somebody and that kind of a response, which reminds me of another person who I asked, how did you get saved? Or where did you get saved? In an airplane. Well, people do get saved in an airplane, so tell me more about it. Well, you know, I was flying from Singapore to London, and we got caught in a storm, and the plane was going up and down. And I said, Lord, save us. And the Lord saved me because the plane landed safely. Well, we kind of had to go through the plan of salvation a little bit more in detail, because that's not what we mean by being saved. So anyway, the person did realize, you know, what salvation was, and I did baptize the couple and the children. So, but you know, if you say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. If we say that we have not sinned, verse 10 says, after we make him a liar, and his word is not in us. All right, so both the Old Testament and the New Testament make it clear that we are all sinners. So, if then all men are sinners, how shall we account for that? So universal an effect must have a universal cause. So the sin of Adam was imputed or reckoned or charged to every member of the human race. And see, this is what we realize. A universal, you know, effect must have a universal cause. So the fact that all cultures have a flood account, it would be indicative that there really was a universal flood, not just a local flood somewhere in the Middle East. But if you go to the American Indians, go to the Incas, you know, Central South America, they all have accounts of a flood. Well, how did it get all the way to South America? You know, well, it was a universal flood. That's why. And this was carried on from Noah and his children and the generations from there as they spread throughout the world. So that's why we say universal effect, a universal cause. There was an actual flood, and there was an actual account of sin with Adam and Eve eating the fruit that God told them, don't eat it. Now this brings us to another question, and that is the question of the imputation of sin. And that is the question, how did sin get passed on from one generation to the next? Basically, that is the question. Alright? So how does the sin go from Adam to his children and ultimately to us? And so we say the imputation of sin, immediate imputation. Okay. Now, there has been general agreement as to the universality of sin. People are agreed there. You know, sin all over the world. But there have been different representations as far as the connection between the sin of Adam and that of his descendants. But I don't want to spend a lot of time, it gets very technical, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on these different views on the imputation of sin. There's basically four views. Pelagianism, semi-Pelagianism, you know, immediate imputation, and median imputation. So these are the four views. But I don't want to bother you with Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism, or even for that matter, median imputation. So rather than looking at the three false views, let us just look at the one view that is biblical, because there's only one view that is biblical. So Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism are not biblical. You know, immediate imputation also is not biblical. So let's look then, and we'll take some start on that at least today, on the question of immediate imputation. Now what do we mean by even the word imputation, or the verb impute? To impute is simply to attribute to. As we are said to impute good or bad motives to anyone. What were his motives for doing this? Did he have good motives? Did he have bad motives? You know, some people come to church so they can do business. You know, I'll go to church, I can meet more people, and I can do business. That's the reason. Some people go to church because they get free food. Of course, in our case, we only have it once a month. But still, you know, if I come first Sunday of the month, I can have a free markan. So I'll go to church. So what are the motives, you know, that people have? So what kind of motive do we impute there, attribute to the person? So in the juridical and theological sense of the word, to impute is to attribute anything to a person or persons upon adequate grounds as the judicial or meritorious reason of reward or punishment. In other words, of the bestowment of good or the infliction of evil. All right? So we need to look at that a little bit more here. You know, but to impute, to attribute anything to a person, why do they do this? Is it good? Is it bad? So to impute then is to reckon to or to lay to one's account. So far as the meaning of the word is concerned, it makes no difference whether the thing imputed be sin or righteousness. We impute sin, the imputation of sin. That could also be the imputation of righteousness. Alright? How is righteousness passed on? How is sin passed on? So, whether it's our own personally, or whether it's the sin or the righteousness of another person. So I may be concerned about myself, I may be concerned about other people. You know, how was it passed on? So, that's why we say it makes no difference whether the thing imputed be good or bad. Whether it be sin, which is bad, or righteousness, which is good. It's still the same word. is still the imputation. Alright? Now in this case we're talking about the imputation of sin. But we could also talk about the imputation of righteousness. So to impute sin then, in scriptural and theological language, because imputation is a technical term, is to impute, to attribute to, the guilt of sin. So it's not only sin, but the guilt of sin. Guilty or not guilty. You may have seen on TV recently there was a court case in the United States, which I'm sure that most of you would have seen. And we, the members of the jury, declare Dr. Murray guilty. Alright? So he's guilty of manslaughter in the case of Michael Jackson. Alright? But he's clear. You know, they listened to the evidence and they back and forth the defense and the prosecution and they say guilty. Alright? So that's the decision, the court. So there is guilt involved. So the guilt of sin. And by guilt is meant the judicial obligation to satisfy justice. So sometime after a person is declared guilty, then the judge has to decide what the penalty will be. Alright? Said Dr. Murray, I guess he could get 4 years or whatever, you know, but it's a question. You know, somebody, well, we have a case here in Perth, you know, with that murder case, and he got life, alright? Which means he'll be out after 18 years. To me, that is not life. You know, but anyway, that's something else. So, but you know, he is declared guilty of the murder of that great buddy, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Alright? So there we have the idea there. So that's why I say by guilt is meant the judicial obligation to satisfy justice. So the judge says, alright, or the jury says guilty, or the judge says guilty, depending on the situation. Alright, the jury says we find the defendant guilty. Alright, then the judge has to decide. He looks at the law books and he says, okay, for this particular crime, okay, that's the penalty. So he says, all right, life in prison, 4 years in prison, whatever it is. So justice must be satisfied. So hence, the evil consequent on the imputation is not an arbitrary infliction. It's not arbitrary. It's not one day the judge gets out of the wrong side of bed and he says, oh, I'm in a bad mood. You got 25 years in prison. Next day, it's my birthday. Oh, 6 months is good enough for the same crime. Cannot be arbitrary. Has to be consistent there. So the evil consequent on the imputation is not an arbitrary infliction. Not merely a misfortune or a calamity. Not a chastisement or chastisement in the proper sense of the word, but a punishment. It has to be punishment. In other words, an evil inflicted in execution of the penalty of law and for the satisfaction of justice. An evil inflicted. So many years in prison. That would be the evil inflicted. Alright? In the execution of the penalty of law. And then, justice has been satisfied. First, you know, with these two cases, the one here and the other one in California, you know, you see a lot of people, justice, justice, justice. You know, yeah, he got justice. He's declared guilty. So that's the word that's often used, justice. And so this also is involved here, the satisfaction of justice. But now, of course, we're not talking about a human judge. We're talking about God. You know. But how did Adam's sin get passed on to us? So the imputation of Adam's sin to us. And for that matter, it's not only a question of Adam's sin being imputed to us, but
the righteousness of Christ is imputed to us. Alright? When we come to faith in Christ, there is that imputation as well. So it's not only a question then of Adam's sin being imputed to us, but also the righteousness of Christ being imputed to us. But that we'll talk about next week, more detail. So next week we'll start with a small C on page 16 in our notes.